This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is The Murder of Mary Fagan, Part 1. By way of introduction, I'd like to paraphrase a bit from a brief article titled The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Death of Leo Frank. I want to explain who Mary Fagan was. Mary Fagan was a young girl who lived in Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States. 100 years ago, she was bludgeoned, raped, and strangled to death 5 weeks before her 14th birthday. And this happened in 1913. Leo Frank, a Jew from New York, who was the superintendent of the National Pencil Company, was indicted and tried for the crime. Though Frank was convicted, the governor of Georgia eventually commuted Frank's sentence to life in prison. A little less than 2 months later, 25 men who called themselves the Knights of Mary Fagan took Frank from the state penitentiary where he was being held to Marietta, where Mary Fagan's family was from. And with a rope, they hung him by his neck from a tree until he was dead. I want to provide in this installment and the ones to follow, and there will be several, I can't say for sure how many, but it'll probably go into the new year. I want to give an overview and really a meta view of this murder and the trial. I want to talk about some things that happened before, and especially the try and get a sense of what the United States, what society in the United States was like 100 years ago. And also in the 100 years since, talk about the trial related things that have continued to happen. And it, the trial continues, the murder and the trial continue to reverberate to this day. Still in the news, and if not in many people's minds. So I'm going to give some background on the events, and I'm going to talk about the crime, and maybe most of the detail this time around will be about the crime and the murder and this, the facts of the situation. And then eventually I'll get into the trial, which was a big deal at the time. It was called the trial of the century, 13 years into the new century. Imagine today if a trial had occurred and people were already calling it the trial of the century, and it really lived up to its name until, well, I don't know, I haven't prepared a list, but there were other significant trials that occurred in the 20th century, but this one in the United States at least really ranks up there toward the top. And as I say, I want to talk also about the aftermath and the legacy of this murder and trial. One of the, it's unfortunate maybe that I didn't do this series, didn't dig into this back in April and through August when the murder and the trial was exactly 100 years past. But I think, you know, I didn't want to interrupt that series that I was doing investigating race and the Jews, and I'm glad I've gotten that done into a clean point now, because what I really want to do in considering this murder in the trial is relate it to race and the Jews, and in particular explore the relations between whites and Jews, and between whites and blacks, and between Jews and blacks, which I think this trial, examining this trial, will help us do. And having that year's worth of more detailed understanding of race and the Jews will help in this retrospective look at what was going on 100 years ago. Another thing that would help is, for those of you who aren't already listening to The International Jew, which is also on the White Network, I would recommend that you start at the beginning there and listen to that, because that was also contemporaneous with this. It was going on at the same time. It was being written at about the same time, about 5 years later, after this murder and trial. What listening to that podcast will do for you is give you a sense of what white Americans were thinking at the time about the Jewish takeover of the United States, and just how thoroughly the Jews had already taken over the United States in 1920. So, and we're going to get into some of the details, I think, of that in later installments on this topic here in this podcast. And maybe I will talk a little bit about things that maybe relate to it from The International Jew, Henry Ford's great classic work. I want to highlight certain points. I'm not going to advertise this or pretend that this is going to be some sort of encyclopedic review of the trial itself. I'm going to go where my interest leads me, and I'm going to focus on certain points, especially the ones having to do with race and the Jews, and drill deep into certain aspects depending upon how time and curiosity leads me. And I expect probably I'll touch on some things that will give me some ideas on future podcasts, things to pursue for more detailed research separate and apart from Mary Fagan and Leo Frank. I hope that I'll bring up some things that maybe even somebody who's, listeners who are familiar with this case already and think that they know all the details, that maybe I'll find some surprising things that that even you didn't know. I'm myself, just to let you know, I really didn't know anything about this case other than Leo Frank's name and some vague details that it was a long time ago, early in the 20th century, and it was a little girl, and even the Jewish aspect of it didn't stand out in my mind so much. I mean, I knew that it had to do with the Jew, because, you know, the Jews complain about that, and I'll make that point in a bit. But I'm coming at this almost like a blank slate. You know, I what I'm presenting to you here is the results of my investigation, my research, my trying to make sense of what happened 100 years ago and to explore it. And so, you know, excuse me if I make some missteps, if I cite some sources that turn out to be bad, or if I state some things as fact that turn out not to be the fact, or were overturned later or something like that. I'm going to present what I've discovered, what I think is interesting, and I'm perfectly willing to be corrected. And if people want to write in the comments to the program either corrections or pointers to me of avenues that I should explore, I'll be welcome to consider them. I can't promise that I'll get into every detail that's suggested. And I've already got quite a bit mapped out. I mean, I know that there's several podcasts worth of stuff to go into here. I just, it will take me some time to chew through it a half an hour at a time, because it actually takes much more than that to organize the information and try and present it in a sensible fashion. So two of the little facts, I think, right off the bat that I want to call attention to. The first one is something that I had thought, and I think it was erroneous. I'm led to believe now. And that is that it was in response to this Leo Frank trial and his lynching that Jews formed the Anti-Defamation League. Because 1913 is this milestone year where the Federal Reserve was founded and the ADL was formed. And that apparently is not entirely true. It was the year that the ADL was formed, but according to Abraham Foxman, who runs the ADL now, in an article I'll probably talk about in the future, he claims that the process was already underway before the murder and trial. And I believe that because I found some other things that that the Jews were up to. And as I say, with the international Jew, it's clear that in the context of what was going on at the time in the United States, that the Jews were climbing into power and overt power. You know, they were taking control and rubbing a lot of people the wrong way. So the ADL was not so much a reaction so much as it was Jews doing what Jews usually do, which is organize with their own best interests in mind and to advance their own interests. So that's factoid number one. And another fact that I didn't know was that the second instance of the Ku Klux Klan was formed in part because of this trial, this murder and this trial. The same article that I paraphrased there at the beginning, which is I found it to be a kind of a neutral article. It was good as far as it was a short one-page description of the that gives you a pretty good overview of the events mentioned, and it was seems to me like it was almost one of the main points. It really concluded the article with this fact that the KKK was formed as a result. It says that it was on a Thanksgiving evening late in 1915, which was just a few months after the lynching had occurred, that some of those Knights of Mary Fagan gathered with some other men. There were 34 in total, and they burned a cross and read from the Bible atop Stone Mountain east of Atlanta and declared the founding of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, in my mind, that second instance of the Ku Klux Klan, the first having been founded in during the Reconstruction, directly in the aftermath of the Civil War, the war between the states, I had always thought that the trigger for the formation of the Klan was Birth of a Nation. And so I wanted to reconcile this new information that it was actually the trial of Leo Frank and his lynching that triggered it. So I looked up the Birth of a Nation, and Wikipedia actually has a page for it. And there's a couple of things to note about that. But first, you know, a few years ago when I first saw Birth of a Nation, it's an old film, of course. It was produced in 1915. It was, or at least it was released theatrically in 1915. It's a black and white film. It's a silent film. It's a long film. And when you first sit down to watch it, it's hard. You know, if you're conditioned by modern media, the modern Jewish media in full sound and surround sound and all these flashing things going on and lots of excitement and action, then this movie is full of action. And actually, after you get over the initial jarring difference from today's films, watching it is actually pretty easy. But and it tells an enthralling story, a story that I bet that 99 out of 100 white Americans don't know today, and they would be well educated and benefit from seeking out this movie, The Birth of a Nation, and watching it. Burn it on a DVD and watch it. And that's what I had to do. Is I went on to BitTorrent to get it, because I went to Netflix to try and rent it, and this movie, which is a classic, wasn't available, as I recall, 3 or 4 years ago when I first tried to find it. So I got it off the net elsewhere. I just went to Netflix to double check myself, and it's available now. So, or at least they say that it is. Sometimes you add a movie to your queue, and they only tell you days or weeks later that they can't find it, and never do find it. There's certain movies. I'll maybe do a podcast on movies Netflix doesn't carry, you know, old classics, and this is one of those. Anyway, about the film, even Wikipedia has to admit that the film was a commercial success at the time that it was made in 1915. But was highly controversial owing to its portrayal of African-American men, played by white actors in blackface, as unintelligent and sexually aggressive towards white women. And the portrayal of the Ku Klux Klan, whose original founding is dramatized, as a heroic force. Well, that's what's great about the film, actually. It's a film made by a white man, based on a story written by a white man that was both of whom were proud to be white. And it was played to an audience that was proud to be white and inspired the audience to feel proud about being white and to feel proud about the United States. And despite the subject matter being this great war, the war between the states, great in the sense of being huge, and huge in the psyche still of Americans in that day. I mean, we're talking only 50 years after the end of the Civil War. So it was very real in the, there were still people alive that had experienced the war in 1913. You just have to think about, to put it in today's terms, you know, based on 2013, looking back to an equivalent time, it's as if the Civil War had occurred in 1965. So it's, for the people alive in 1915 when they saw this film, it was very real to them. And it was also at the dawn of the age of films, of motion pictures, and was considered a breakthrough in that respect, too. It was, in fact, Wikipedia notes this, too, that that it was played in the White House by President Woodrow Wilson, who was very much enthralled to the Jews, but at least had the good sense to screen this film in the White House. It was the first motion picture to be shown at the White House. And the Wikipedia page does note that the film was credited as one of the events that inspired the formation of the, quote, second era, unquote, Ku Klux Klan at Stone Mountain, Georgia, in the same year. But you know what? The funny thing is they don't mention the Leo Frank trial and the murder of Mary Fagan in that Wikipedia page. And as I mentioned, I had never heard that before. I didn't know. I didn't realize that the trial had occurred in the same year and that it had anything to do with the founding of the KKK. The article, that neutral article that I began this installment reading from or paraphrasing from, actually itself starts as describing, you know, struggling with how to describe what it is that it wants to talk about. It says, to some it is, quote, the murder of Mary Fagan, unquote. Others call it, quote, the trial of Leo Frank, unquote. And this is something that I also struggled with here is what to title this series of installments. And, you know, Leo Frank is the big name today, looking back at that. And he is definitely a central figure. But I don't like the idea of talking about the Leo Frank trial. I want to talk about the whole thing, everything about it, as I've already described, but especially Mary Fagan, I think, is the one who deserves to be memorialized by what happened, not Leo Frank. And, you know, it really comes down to your point of view. The people in Atlanta, Georgia, the white folk in Atlanta, Georgia, certainly thought of it as the murder of Mary Fagan, first and foremost. The trial was the consequence of that murder. But today, the Jews, who have so much control over the media and academia, over the narrative as to how we all in the United States and around the world view history. That's why Leo Frank is the big name and the big face associated with this incident and all the events around it. In fact, the article that I cited, I said it's a neutral article, but it wasn't really. It mentioned the KKK. It didn't mention the ADL. And in fact, it didn't mention Jews at all. It didn't mention Leo Frank's being a Jew. I inserted that word in the description because I wanted to put it right up front, because that's the kind of thing I'm going to do. I'm going to dig up information from all sorts of sources, and I'm going to point out race and Jews where it's appropriate, where it is meaningful, even if the people that I'm citing don't. And, in fact, highlight it, as I do in this case right now, because what I find in looking for descriptions of the case is I find mostly – one of two views. I either find views like this neutral one that don't mention Leo Frank's Jewishness. And admittedly, it's a brief article, so maybe that's why they don't mention it. They, you know, too many other things. But if they go into the details of the KKK, which to me sounds like, you know, that's something somehow I missed in all of the summaries, however many I've encountered in my life before, that gave me my little thumbnail idea of what the trial was about. I was lacking that KKK connection. So anyway, you know, the point I want to make is that the other type of story that you see is the one that puts Leo Frank's Jewishness right out front. It's the central issue of the story. And of course, those stories are the ones that tend to come from Jews. And in fact, the Jews are the root of that story. They're the root of pushing Leo Frank's Jewishness to the forefront. I get the impression from reading the facts of the case as laid down at the time of the trial, that Frank's Jewishness, of course, was mentioned, and it was important, but it wasn't the all-important thing. It was just one of many things. And I think one of the lessons that comes out looking back into the past here is that the white people of the United States and of Atlanta, Georgia, didn't really see Jews as aliens, as alien enough to keep out of their country. They thought that Jews were different. Certainly, it's worse today that white Americans just, for the most part, are oblivious as to the nature of Jews and just how alien and hostile Jews are to whites. Well, let's put it this way. In a certain part of their mind, I think they must be aware of it because it's around us every day. It's in the news. The Jews put it in their media. They put their expressions of their hostility toward whites. But whites tend to look the other way. And that's, you know, this neutral article that I started off with here is an example of that, where they just sort of ignore the fact that Leo Frank was a Jew. And they have to be ignoring it because when you go out there and you search for Leo Frank, just search for the two words, Leo Frank, the Jews are right there putting his Jewishness out front, and they're the ones who do that. They think his Jewishness is important. So, you know, whites who want to know about this case really can't avoid the Jewishness of Leo Frank. The Jews shove it in your face. And as usual, the moral of their version, the moral of their narrative about the Leo Frank case, which they call the Leo Frank trial, or the Leo Frank lynching, or the Leo Frank affair, or the Leo Frank travesty, I actually found being used, as if Leo Frank was the victim. And in a sense, that is exactly what they're doing. And it's what they always do. It's how they always deal with their malfeasance, with when a Jew does something wrong. Most of the time, if possible, if not all of the time, the Jews figure out some way to flip it around, and it's everybody else's fault. It's everybody and anybody else's fault. Now, they don't blame Mary Fagan necessarily. At least I haven't run into anything yet. Maybe digging into the trial, I'll find some insinuation that this 13-year-old, 14-year-old girl made some sort of pass at Frank, but they blame a black man that we'll get into more the details of that as we go along. And that really threw a monkey wrench into the relationship between blacks and Jews back in the early part of the century. That has since, I think, been forgotten mostly, especially by blacks, but Jews haven't forgotten. Jews probably know more about this trial than the average white person does. In fact, I want to bring up here now the Jewish version, and probably won't have enough time to get all the way through this time, but we'll just I'm not going to try and pinch off these installments in clean, logically separate parts. I'm just going to, you know, stop when I run out of time, and we'll pick it up again the next time. So as a Jewish version, and this is a pretty good extreme version, I found an article titled "An American Lynching: The Leo Max Frank Affair," and this was in the Jerusalem Post, an Israeli media outlet, and it was one of a series by an author named David Turner. There's the name game for you. That's not a very Jewish name, but I'm assuming he's a Jew because he acts like a hyper Jew. He's got a blog whose title is "Antisemitism and Jewish Survival." So that sort of lets you know right from off the bat, this guy is absolutely focused on Jewish survival, the Jewish people, and what's good for them. And the little blurb describing this author of this article says that he was the first director of the Organization for Justice for the Pollards. And he also created Jews United to Defend the Auschwitz Cemetery. Now, the Pollards refers to Jonathan and Esther Pollard. And I don't know much about Esther, but I know Jonathan Pollard was a spy for Israel, convicted 20-odd years ago for spying against the United States. And he's still in jail. And lots of Jews can't get over the fact that a Jew would actually be accused of a crime, convicted of a crime, and actually have to serve time for a crime. And this is a good example where Pollard, if I were going to cite examples of Jews behaving as they did in the Leo Frank case, Jonathan Pollard would be a great contemporary example of how Jews just cannot accept that one of their own be subjected to the same standards that the rest of us are, because the Jews are special, and the Jews always lobby in whatever country they live in for special treatment, meaning better treatment for themselves. So here's Turner's introduction. "The trial and murder of Leo Frank stands in stark contrast to the outcomes of those other contemporaneous anti-Semitic outrages. The trial," and he puts that in quotes, "the trials of Menachem Bayless and Alfred Dreyfus. In the end, Russia and France, however reluctantly, recanted, and their victims survived. Not so the American Jew, Leo Frank. This incident illustrates the depth of antisemitism present in the United States for decades preceding the First World War, a level that only intensified after the war and continued to do so through the Second World War and beyond. It was this same antipathy toward the Jews, endemic to Western culture, that resulted in America violating its long tradition of refuge as a last resort, at least when it came to Europe's Jews fleeing the Holocaust." And so there we have it right in the first paragraph. He's tying Leo Frank's trial together with the Jewish narrative of their history amongst Europeans as being one long, sorry tale of suffering on the part of the Jews because of a problem, an antipathy toward the Jews endemic to Western culture.